Hello, everybody. Welcome into another episode of Debate Night. We got a great episode tonight. A lot of fun topics, and we got a new guest analyst today. Before we get into that, we got to give a thanks to today's sponsor, Manscaped. Today, we're here to celebrate the perfect summer grooming companion that'll keep you looking cool even when it's sizzling outside. I'm excited to announce the new Lawnmower 5.0 Ultra and the new colorway White Hot from Manscaped. You can step up your grooming game this summer with the Lawnmower 5.0 Ultra in White Hot. Experience precision like never before with next-gen dual skin-safe blade heads and updated trimmer blade and interchangeable foil blade for peak performance. These updated blades are not just for show. They're designed to keep you looking smooth and sleek under the summer sun. First, the updated trimmer blade features longer, wider, and rounded teeth that cut through hair with ease. And here's where things get interesting. The foil blade, crafted to transcend the boundaries of your typical trim, achieved with the trimmer blade, this foil blade is designed to leave you with a finish that is irresistibly sleek and utterly bare. It glides gently over your skin, capturing even the finest hairs for a flawless look that's ready to impress. So if you want to check out all this from Manscaped, you can join the 10 million men worldwide who already trust them for their grooming needs, and you can get the Lawnmower 5.0 Ultra in the White Hot at manscaped.com. You can get 20% off plus free shipping with code DebateNight. That's 20% off plus free shipping with code DebateNight at manscaped.com. Thanks again to Manscaped for sponsoring tonight's episode. Let's introduce our analyst for tonight. Brody is here as always, man of the people.
Yeah, you know, that's a term that's been thrown around quite a bit on this show. Firstly, I am the only one that has man of the people shirt merch, so true. That also, I decided to give out free MacBook Pros this week. What's more man of the people of that? Hunter, you're welcome. You can get one of those.
I missed my opportunity.
By the way, if you did get fooled that if you thought that was me and not a hacker, that's on you. I have never and will never address everyone. Hello, Twitter family. Okay. That I don't know what's up with these hackers and their AI, but that was clear as day that clearly that was not me. But going back to last week's episode, we have Pitch Perfect with the most favorite or most liked comment saying Trevor turns into a teenage girl at the thought of AB watching him. Then we have Understable Dave saying, can we please let all four panelists have their say before all interjecting from the host and two guys who had already had their say? Poor guys are just staring into the camera, possibly seeing their insights being debated into the ground before they even had a chance to mention them. So I know I'm a fault at this, so I will do my best to say my points and then wait until the very end for a rebuttal.
I think the last episode had a few of those sticky topics where like we just couldn't let them go past, and we definitely got caught on them a little bit. I'll concede that. Hunter is here. He finally managed to reset his computer. Looking good.
I did. I missed out on the deal of a lifetime with Brody's Twitter. I did get it on the Linus Tech Tip deal of a lifetime though.
Twitter family.
It was weird. They were offering the same thing, same wording too. I don't know what's going on.
They worked so fast because I was actually going live. It was a terrible timing for me because I was literally going live when it happened. And so I didn't know what was happening. And so when at the end, after I was done doing the live show, I checked my email and it was literally someone signed in St. Petersburg, Russia. And that was at like, 5:58. And then like 5:59, someone changed your password. 6 o'clock, they gave... They turned off two-step verification, which is crazy. Why do I have two-step verification if people can hack through it? Doesn't make any sense. Then they turned it back on a minute later. Then they gave a next minute, they gave permission to Beatrice 12758, who I'm guessing is the hacker, to delegate stuff. And then the next minute they changed my password. So literally, they did all that in a matter of like 3 minutes. So hats off to them. They work pretty quick.
Yeah, we've been there. And the one time it happened to us, we were in a meeting. And so by the time we got out of there, it was the same thing. It was like, oh, man.
Yeah.
Whole string of unfortunate emails.
Shout out to Elon, too, for firing all your content side of people. Because now I just don't have a Twitter.
No Twitter.
Oh, you still just don't have a Twitter?
You just send an email in now. Before, I mean, I had a contact there, but they got fired. Before you could just be like, hey man, someone hacked my Twitter, and within 5 seconds, boom, you have your Twitter back. But all those people are gone now. So you just send an email saying, hey, my Twitter's hacked.
Tough.
And you just wait, I guess.
Dang.
No, shout out to Elon.
We're also joined today. We got a new analyst today. Scott is joining us. Scott, tell me a little about yourself. How confident are you going in this episode?
Hey, my name's Scott. I'm 24. I'm from Dallas, Texas. Longtime listener. Excited to be here for my first time. Definitely a little nervous and just hoping I get some points. That's the goal.
Well, we'll see what happens. Fun fact about Scott, what hooked me immediately was that he said he has won the Socrates Award for debating in school. I had read that, but then I had to go back and like double check because I was like, I'm pretty sure this guy said he won something called the Socrates Award. And that's, I mean, that's impressive. So how hard was it to win that award?
I was in a class called Human Letters where we pretty much read and discussed philosophy, and the discussions had, you know, a Socratic format. We were all talking about stuff, feeding off each other. And just at the end of the year, the teacher selected the person who won. So there I've always loved debating. And yeah, hopefully I can bring my A game for tonight.
Scott, I've read some literature that says that yelling in a debate is actually not good. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that it's better to be heard, and people hear you better when you talk to them calmly, you know? De-escalate the situation so people understand you.
Nah, it's not a good debater. It's not a good debater.
Yeah, good luck de-escalating, Brody. We'll see how that works. And then we're also joined tonight by Lucas. Been a little while since Lucas has been on the show. Busy guy, but he's back today. Looking for another win.
Yeah. I know you guys like your random tournament merch, so I'm repping my Belching Turkey 19.
I love it.
Gotta have it. Sick. If you guys want to look it up, it's a great tournament in Chattanooga area. So,
you know what, Hunter, I need to write this down. We need to do a Grippy Award for best local tournament name.
Oh, and just get submitted. That's a great
because one. Because I'm sure we would hear some. I mean, I've just from the tournaments I've played, I've heard some that like you could hardly believe are real.
Need a best local trophy too, because some C tier trophies they're out there. I've gotten quite a few photos of some wild ones.
Yeah, there is the best one in my area was called. There was two that were great: the Crawdad Cooker and the Buck Miller Super Thriller. Two of my favorites.
I love that Super Thriller.
Lucas, were you sailing around the world? Where have you been?
No. So I graduated. That was the last time that I was on. Like I had just graduated. And then, my wife got accepted to medical school at ETSU,
which is
like a couple hours away. So we just like moved up, to a different spot, got our first house and all that. So really busy time actually. So
you just seem like someone that have a boat.
All right. Fair enough. Well, let's hop into our first topic tonight. I always love bringing up this argument. There's sometimes I know an argument's going to get a rise out of certain people, and I just have to bring it up for that reason. But the Olympic Games just wrapped up after a fun 2 weeks of international competition. Good time. Actually got to watch a decent amount of Olympics this time around. I really made that a goal. So my question here is, would disc golf entering the Olympic Games have any sizable impact on our sport? And also, what would you say the likelihood of this happening is? Brody, what do you think?
Okay, so to answer the first question, it's so funny. I feel like every like niche sport is so enthralled. Like you would have no idea how many debates in Ultimate Frisbee people are talking about Ultimate being in the Olympics. I just feel like with every niche sport, everyone wants to get in the Olympics. I understand. It would be cool to like represent your country and all that. But to be honest, like I don't think it actually would have that big of an impact. There are tons of sports that just don't really get any sort of coverage at all. Now, could it turn into something like curling, for example, for me? Like, curling doesn't seem like it would be a sport that would attract a huge audience. But for whatever reason, when the Winter Olympics come around, I am so excited to, you know, wait up until 2 o'clock in the morning or whatever it was last time to watch curling. Does that mean I'm going to go out and join a local curling club? No. But do I get to have a little bit more information or intel on curling? Yeah, I think that's the only issue is like there's a lot of us that love watching the Olympics, and that's the only time we'll ever watch a track and field event. So the thought that there would be a bunch of people that all of a sudden would start tuning into disc golf because of it. I don't think it's gonna have a huge sizable impact. And what's the likelihood? The Olympics, I've heard from years and years and years, have been losing money. So they've been looking at ways of not having a bunch of sports that can bring a whole lot of people. If disc golf is one of those where it's like only 10 countries are represented, then I see maybe it might have a shot.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, hey, breakdancing is in there. All right, Hunter, what do you think? What is your take on disc golf at the Olympics?
Yeah. So originally I was in the exact same camp as Brody, where I'm like, I think people think this is a much bigger deal than it would be, but I looked into what it did for skateboarding to try to open my mind a little bit. And it actually opened my eyes to an angle I hadn't thought of before. So people in the skateboard industry said like it definitely increased popularity a little bit. There was traffic to parks and website traffic and all the typical stuff that you're like, yeah, that makes sense. You know, none of them were like crazy, crazy numbers. But a huge benefit they talked about that I had never thought of was the legitimacy it gave to their sport when they were trying to get more skate parks in. So I think being in the Olympics, that helped skateboarding feel more legitimate and less like some of the like outside, you know, rebellious sport. I think that's where the biggest benefit would come for disc golf. Cause we saw with COVID, right, that just because a lot of people get into the sport doesn't mean we're going to keep a lot of people in the sport. And with a huge influx of money, sometimes disc golf companies don't know what to do with that money. And by sometimes I mean 4 years ago. So that doesn't necessarily mean the growth of the sport if there were some big influx, but I think it could really incentivize course installation all across the world and also motivate parks and rec departments to actually invest in the courses that are already in the grounds, as they would help them see it as a legit sporting facility and not just something random they have to mow around. So I think from that side, it could actually have a pretty decent impact on our sport, just that it would be actually treated as a sport instead of just some type of a hobby. And I think it has a okay chance. I think it's nothing crazy. I wouldn't surprise me if it happened in my lifetime.
Okay. Yeah, that is a very good point. I definitely see that angle of, you know, anytime you can go to a representative and be like, hey, this is an Olympic sport, can we put in a course? That's a pretty big selling point. Because, you know, they might not be analyzing the Olympic effect as much as we are. They're just kind of hearing that word. Scott, what do you think about disc golf and its potential in the Olympic Games?
So I think entering the Olympic Games would have a measurable impact on disc golf. Not only is there a huge increase in media coverage about the new sports, entering the Olympics, for example, rock climbing and skateboarding, the two most recent additions had hundreds of articles by dozens of media companies written about them. There's also been a measurable impact on the prize purse in international sport climbing. So a paper published in 2022 by Rigaud et al. Found that participants understood that additional finances would provide athletes with more opportunities to skate and climb professionally. So being in the Olympics also comes with additional investors in the sport. The Olympic Committee itself can invest in it, and it's going to make you more attractive to other sponsors being in the Olympics. And in 2019, on the international sport climbing competition, a first place win got you $2,000. In 2023, that is up to $5,000. So it's 150% increase in first place. You know, not all of that is attributed to being in the Olympics, but I would say some of it has. And in terms of likelihood of it happening, there's two different canoeing events in the Olympics. The most recent one was added in 1972, but I think disc golf is a lot more accessible to the masses than canoeing.
fair point at the end of the day. No, that it is fair to say that when a new sport gets added, it does tend to get that. I mean, anytime that's a big thing for media to latch onto, you know, the breakdancing, the flag football, maybe coming next time around, they'll at least give it that initial coverage. Lucas, all right, wrap it up for us. What are your thoughts on disc golf at the Olympics?
Yeah, I'm going to do kind of the last question first. I did some research, and the odds of becoming an Olympic sport aren't all that implausible. In fact, there are really just a few criteria that would pose the biggest obstacles. Based on the current requirements that I looked at on the Olympics website, it seems like there are about 35 relatively subjective criteria, including the value added from the sport, how old the sport is, popularity in the host country, production costs, and other things like that. The more objective things that I could find, objective metrics, were that it has to be played by 75 countries for men, 40 countries for women, and across three continents. It must be governed by an international federation that oversees the sport and supervises the play and development of their respective sports. And adherence to Olympic charter that includes things like non-doping requirements. And so how does disc golf do on that? According to UDisc, in 2023, there were 90 countries recorded. So that's plausible. We do have the PDGA. They would be directly in charge of the event. But they would also have to start doing drug testing, which is expensive and could cause some problems based on what we know about the sport right now. And it would also have to be hosted in a country or region where disc golf has a good course to showcase. So would it be helpful to disc golf? I think if we look at other examples, we see that it would probably cause the biggest impact in smaller countries. Disc golf has engulfed Estonia in large part due to Kristen. And for an example outside of disc golf, just look at what Novak Djokovic has done for disc golf, or sorry, for tennis in Serbia. It wasn't a super popular thing there, but since Novak has started just dominating, it could increase the popularity in smaller countries similar to what Novak has done.
Yeah, no, I actually really like that point. You get that effect from the Olympics. There's a lot of small country heroes almost you see in the games a lot of times. So I definitely can see that happen. And yeah, I was wondering if anybody would bring it up because there is criteria that the Olympic sports are supposed to meet. And it does bring a smile to my face thinking about the PDGA being in charge of an Olympic event. Just put them on the largest scale imaginable.
We got rebuttals for this or no?
Yeah, you can always rebuttal.
All right. First thing, rebuttal is for Scott. I hear this a lot, and we do this sometimes in disc golf where we're like, hey, the purse went from this to this. That's a blah, blah, blah increase. Scott, if I gave you $1 and then a year from now, I'm like, you know what, Scott, you did great. I'm going to give you 100% increase. And I gave you $2. That sounds really good, but it's $1 to $2, $2,000 to $5,000. Like that's just nothing. That's just nothing to like have any sort of like, holy cow, the sport's blowing up. $5,000. I mean, I'm axe throwing. The winner of the world championship in axe throwing gets $50,000. So yeah. To me, like, I just feel like some of these times people like throwing out these percentages of like, look at the increase. And it's like, I'm not impressed. Now, if it went from 2 million to 5 million, now all of a sudden, like, okay, that's impressive. Wow, that's a huge growth. 2,000 to 5,000, not impressive at all. Hunter, also, do you remember when trampolining got into the Olympics, Hunter?
Oh, I would never forget.
I know. There was so much media about it. Like, everyone was talking about it.
Was social media around back then?
Yeah, it was, actually.
When trampolining went into the Olympics? No.
Sure.
What?
All I know is Silas and I think it was like towards the beginning of it. Trampolining.
Trampoline is a pretty old Olympic sport.
2000. I'm pretty sure it was like in the beginning of... I'm pretty sure I had a Twitter in 2005. When did Twitter come out? YouTube's definitely was out by then.
Well, I'm just saying. I mean, I think the media landscape's a little different.
No, I know what you're saying. 2006.
I want to respond to Brody. I agree with you that the increase from $2,000 to $5,000 is not impressive. What does matter is the number of 150%. The reality of sport climbers, professional sport climbers competing internationally is that they are completely reliant on their sponsors and in some cases even crowdfunding petitions from their followers to help fund these events. So to an athlete competing in that sport, an extra $3,000 means that's three more World Cup tournaments I can attend.
Oh, I'm not disagreeing with that.
In different areas.
I'm not disagreeing with that. I'm just saying if you took that and someone was like, hey, is rock climbing on the up and up? And you're like, yeah, it's blowing up. It grew 150% in purses. And they're like, really? And you're like, it went from 2,000 to 5,000. No one's going to take that. But
for the record, trampoline came in 2000.
That's what I said. 2000. That's what I said. 2000. 2000.
Yeah, no social media.
I thought Twitter was around by then. Twitter actually was created in 2006. That's crazy.
I was born a year after. Seems like it's been around. Trampoline.
But I don't know. I still don't know if it's a good comparison. Like
that's not true.
I
you weren't born in 2001.
Year before trampoline. Okay. Yeah. Oh.
I don't know. I don't know how good of a comparison though some of these other sports are though, because like skateboarding to me is like such a huge sport. Like everyone knows about skateboarding,
but no, disc golf would get like the weird factor. I think it would be like, everybody, look what they put in the Olympics.
See, that's disc where golf? I know, but it's like people trash on trampolining being in the Olympics. People trash on breaking being in the Olympics. I'm wondering, like, would disc golf just fall into that? Oh, this is a stupid sport that got in the Olympics. I hope it wouldn't.
Potentially, but those people who think it's stupid are just still not going to play disc golf. I think
But they would push the narrative to a big crowd, is what I'm trying to say. Yeah. Of where it wouldn't, lifted.
I chose skateboarding mainly because it was A, relatively recent addition, and B, it has a similar thing in like it's trying to get put into public parks.
Yeah, but again, the thing is like they had Tony Hawk, who basically revolutionized the sport. There was a video game that like
no, I never said skateboarding and disc golf was the same.
Have we all played Tony Hawk here? Has everyone played the game?
My argument was just that if I go to a local park, of course I play Tony Hawk Pro Skater.
No, Lucas has it.
Lucas,
what the heck, Lucas?
He didn't take it with him on his boat.
Yeah, I guess they get electricity.
My argument was more if I go to a local parks and rec department. And I'm
no, you made a good argument
on disc golf, saying it's an Olympic sport that could have a huge impact. Not necessarily being in the Olympics, but being able to say it's an Olympic sport.
If you would have gone the argument of like it would have gave a street cred to like the general public, I would have completely combated that. But. No. Going to like a parks and rec person and having it down there, I think you're right. I think that would help kind of push some projects through, actually.
Yeah.
It would just be hilarious if disc golf got shoved into the Olympics for only one LA. Olympic Games. And then like the winners that year just happen to be super random people. We'd just be like, hey, remember that time that like Jesse Niemann won a gold medal? Like he's like our gold medalist. It's like because like anything can happen out there. All right, on to the next topic here. So this is a fan submitted topic. In round one of the LWS Open, Missy Gannon reported an incorrect score on a hole. No one on the card disagreed, so the score was submitted after the round as correct. Then, when the post produced coverage was being put together, they noticed the incorrect score and reported it, giving Missy a 2-shot penalty. She posted about this on her Instagram story. So the question here is, should video evidence be allowed to use for score verification? Video replay and pictures are not allowed when determining a ruling or needing clarification from an official. Hunter, what do you think?
Well, so how this question kind of worded the situation and how I heard it are two different things. And I think it's a really important distinction to kind of figure out here, because in the question, how I kind of interpreted it with this question is that the video evidence was what was submitted to make this call be happened, versus how I interpreted what Missy posted was she was kind of shown the video evidence and she reported it on herself. Because if that's the case where she was shown the video evidence after it was cut, then you can't really do anything about it, because the video evidence wasn't what was submitted to make the call. Instead, she was alerted. I understand it was technically what was used, but she was alerted the same as if I would have saw Brody's scorecard after the round and be like, hey, yo, you actually had a 4 here. And then she went and did the right thing. You get what I'm saying? So to me, that's a really important distinction, because that is just something where, what are you supposed to do about that? Like, she was then made aware of, hey, I made a mistake. She did the right thing, went to the PDJ, said, hey, I made a mistake. I actually had this score here. Then she was a 2-stroke penalty was assessed. How she got that information in this case happened to be video evidence, but I think that you immediately will hear those two and tie them together and think, oh, video evidence was directly used to make this call, when was it? Kind of, but not by the tournament director. So you can't really create a rule like, oh, well, if the video is shown to this person, they can't, like that. To me, it's because it went to Missy and Missy turned it in. If that's actually how it happened, then there's no way around it. Like, it sucks, is what it is. But yeah.
Yeah, a little bit of an interesting conundrum there, I think. Scott, what are your thoughts on the situation?
My first thought is that I had no idea about that, Hunter, and I agree that is a very important distinction, because when I hear of Missy being found aware of it herself and then following the rules of golf, having that player integrity to go and make the call on herself, I think that's exactly what she should have done, and that is different than I initially interpreted it. So my initial impression of thinking that video was used after the fact by a tournament official to judge Missy, that is allowed under PDGA rules. The only time you can use video evidence is to evaluate player misconduct. It can't be used on a ruling, but it's listed on their website. It can be used for player misconduct. But we've run into a problem there, because what percentage of cards are actually filmed? So only the cards that are actually filmed could ever have this used against them. And for most of the players, it's just not going to apply to them. So in that instance, I would say this should not have happened because not all players on the course are filmed. And this rule couldn't have been applied to everyone. And that's all I had.
Yeah, no, that definitely is a always going to be the weird thing with video evidence. Lucas, how do you weigh in on this?
Yeah, I do agree that it's like a chain of command issue in terms of like the actual like letter of the law type of thing that Hunter was talking about. But I really think that this question and situation really speaks to two broader issues in disc golf rather than just the situation itself. First, not allowing video or photo evidence is really inconceivably foolish to me. That needs to be changed, I think. Second, disc golfers generally are not good enough at keeping score. So first, the video slash photo or cell phone rule. The first time a card mate told me this rule, I was taking a picture of something to show a TD. He was like, you can't do that. I thought he was joking. Other sports use video review or have a rules official on the hole to help with discrepancies. Not being allowed to use technology to get the best call is baffling to me, and it needs to be changed, I think. I know some people will say that we're all certified rules officials, but just like kind of Ricky and Brody were talking about on Tour Life, a lack of standardization means more gray areas, which means we should be allowed any tools necessary to get the right call. With that said, in the Missy situation, I kind of agree that it depends on the chain of command, like I said earlier. Second, the scorekeeping itself, getting to a hole and waiting for everyone to get their phones out and then each individually say three. It's ridiculous. It's probably my biggest disc golf pet peeve. We shouldn't be calling out any scores on the tee box. You should just keep score. Alternatively, I'll go ahead and predict that Brody's going to make the case for fewer players on the card or only keeping score for yourself and one other player like they do in golf, which are also fine solutions. But keeping score for three other people really shouldn't be that much of a burden.
Yeah, definitely happens more often than you would think. Some good points there. Brady, wrap it up for us. What do you think about the Missy situation?
Yeah, just for those that are like confused as to like, oh, well, how would you do it fairly if you were only keeping your score and someone else's? Everyone gets a scorecard, okay? It's a thin piece of paper, and you've got 1 through 18 on the top, and that's where your name is. And on the bottom, you have whoever else in your group that you're keeping score of. So let's say I'm keeping score for Trevor. I put Trevor's name and then all the scores down there. There's a perforated edge already created, perforated line already created. So when we get to hole 18 and we're already done, because I've kept my score, I've kept Trevor's score, all I have to do is I rip that off and I hand it to Trevor. And then Trevor rips his off and he hands it to me. And then I grab it and I put it right underneath my scorecard and I go 3, 3, 4, 4, 5, 5, 5. And I go real quick across. It takes about 5 seconds. Everything's right. Good. We're done. That's all we have to do. I don't know why we're doing all this crazy stuff with people in the cell phones and all that. The video evidence thing is also kind of weird. But the way that Hunter explained it, I think exactly is how it happened. It's done. It's been like this before in the past where people have been made aware of something, and honestly it's on them whether or not they want to come forth. I think there was a tournament where they actually sent an email extension. I think there was a tournament where they actually you know, get this, when you have paragraphs on how to play every hole differently from the other holes, people are going to play holes incorrectly. So they found out that a bunch of people, like 10, 15 people, played a hole incorrectly. So they sent out an email saying, hey, if you did this, please come and let us know because you played the hole incorrectly. Now, how many of those people actually came out and said like, oh, yeah, I did do that? Who knows? But we have seen this in the past, but Hunter's 100% right. Missy didn't have to say, oh, there's video evidence of my score being wrong. I have to go and assess this penalty. She was the one that did it herself.
Yeah, it's a weird one because, like, you're right. It's not technically the authorities using video evidence, but as soon as that video evidence is brought to you and it's known by people, it might as well be the same thing because, like, you got to be crazy to not do it at that point. But yeah, I think it's always going to be a weird one because, you know, Lucas was mentioning if you're in a spot where you feel like you're going to get maybe the wrong call, but you can take a picture and it's right there and it's accessible. Like it's tough to feel like that.
I think the logic behind like local tournaments and stuff is if you take the pictures at certain angles, it can sway. So like the best people to make the call are the people on the ground. Cause like, if I took a picture of a disc from like back here, looking this way, it might be like, oh, that's clearly in bounds. But then you take a picture from right above and it's like, oh, that was definitely out of bounds.
All four card mates need to take a picture, I guess.
That's what I was going to say.
I do think there should be different rules on how video is used between a local tournament and on the disc golf pro tour.
There should be different rules for how everything is done in a local tournament and the pro tour.
Most certainly. Yeah. All right. Well, speaking of cell phones and technology, we're going to talk about our next topic. Got a lot of people riled up, myself included. So spectators for Worlds have been emailed and informed they cannot have their phones while watching at New London and must leave them in their vehicles. Now, this is done definitely to help their broadcast signal issue. But my question here is this a necessary evil to ensure the success of the broadcast? Is that the priority? Or is this such a ridiculous rule that the PDGA should just have to deal with their lack of pre-planning? Is this on them? Are they putting too much on the fans? Scott, what do you think?
I think that not planning for adequate cell phone coverage at the biggest tournament of the year is embarrassing for the World Championships. I think we've all heard of Starlink. Starlink is available outside of Lynchburg, Virginia, where the Worlds is going to be held. That is one option to add us some more data coverage. But on top of that, fans pay for an experience and they want to take pictures of the event. They want to be able to share that online. And disc golf should want that too. People being excited at an event and posting about it only spreads more awareness. You know, if someone's got 100 followers on Instagram, 95 of them probably do not play disc golf. Now, when you look at golf, the Masters in Augusta does not allow cell phone usage. That is a very established tournament, and that is done, you know, out of respect and for the love of the game of golf. I do not think that disc golf is there yet, and I think that we want people to be able to use their phones to share this experience with their followers and the world. So,
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, it definitely inhibits the idea that you can spread the news surrounding the event. Lucas, what do you think about this cell phone policy?
Yeah, I think it really is ridiculous because there are other options that don't involve this extreme solution. I think it... Because of that, and because that it takes away from the natural advertisement that Scott was kind of just talking about, I think that it just is almost an unforgivable mistake. So first, the other solutions, I brainstormed for 15 minutes, and I came up with these three immediate solutions that I think could probably help. First of all, the PDGA plans ahead more by maybe trying to get a specific sponsor for like a network-based or cellular-based thing. I know that Scott just mentioned Starlink, but I know there's other things out there as well. Second, as other people have said, just ask the spectators to do airplane mode. And then third, maybe get Wi-Fi for the entire course and then charge people to use the Wi-Fi at the course. And that will provide money to pay for the Wi-Fi and then also potentially add more money to the purse, which is always a good thing. The second, the loss of experience for the fans. Scott touched on that, so I'm not going to spend too much time on it. But videoing your favorite pro throwing shots is awesome, and depriving people of that at the World Championships is absolutely ludicrous. And then third, the loss of advertisement, which is kind of a different spin on that, the loss of experience for the fans. People taking pictures and posting things is just natural advertising that allows for engagement and letting people know this huge event is going on. Again, Scott mentioned that too. It's free and you don't have to go pay for it, and they're preventing people from doing that. So yeah, it's just not a mistake that should be happening at the biggest event we have.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It feels like yet another shortcoming from the PDGA planning an event. Brody, what do you think about the no cell phone policy?
Yeah, I'm going to disagree with Scott. I think, you know, the PDGA is a company that is innovative and is looking out for the best possible outcomes for their customers and their clients. You know, we're, you know, in today's age, you know, it's disgusting. You go to a concert and you're sitting there trying to enjoy it, and in front of you, you see hundreds and hundreds of cell phones, you know, out in front of you. You know, I think they looked at the Masters and saw what the Masters was and was like, you know what? That's what Worlds should be. No cell phones, no photos, no pictures. You can't tell people where you are on the course. You just got to figure it out. You know, I think it's a beautiful thing that the PGA did.
I bet. Is that it? Is that all you got?
Yeah, that's all I got. Yeah.
Okay. All right. I'll give you maybe a couple points for good satire.
Come on, comedic,
I guess.
Yeah, come on. Comedic timing.
He's a funny guy. Really good. Good satire.
That was amazing.
Be the man. Give him one more bonus point.
Nah. Okay. Hunter, go ahead.
All right. Well, look, if we're looking at this as there's two options, right? A necessary evil, or they just have to deal with it, their lack of pre-panning. I think if those are the only two options, I think it is a necessary evil. Again, that's saying we are acting like airplane mode and going out and visiting the course and trying to get a sponsor. We're acting like all of that's impossible. We're acting like we were dropped in today and we have to make a decision, which they weren't. So I don't want to sound like I'm letting the PDGA off the hook, because this is crazy. We've known World is going to be here for 2 years. It takes 10 minutes for someone to like figure out, hey, we should probably figure out how to get any type of coverage out here. But what we have to think through here, and also side note, because I am one of the spectators, it would have also gone a long way if you realized this problem and just let us know before we paid for our tickets. That would have also been great, because then I would have known what I was paying for. Okay, back into why I say necessary evil is simply because they have to kind of choose between spectator experience on the ground and viewership experience at home is where they're at currently. Right. And so when they're looking at those, they have to cater to the majority, which the majority of people will be viewing this at home. So when they're looking at realistically the two rounds at New London, we're probably looking at 2,500 people on the ground versus thousands and thousands of people, you know, maybe Worlds, maybe close to 10,000 people viewing at home. If the 2,500 people on the ground are going to make it basically unwatchable for the 10,000 people at home, then sure, action does have to be taken, which is why I'm saying it is technically a necessary evil if you were to drop us in right now and we made all the same mistakes the PDGA made, because there was a lot of them.
Yeah, there's no numbers game to be played. My thing, the thing that cracks me up the most is, and I know people are kind of dropping like the Masters comp as like kind of a joke, but I really wish they would have
tried to
just play this off and market it as if like a... We want like this experience where everybody is in the moment and we go back in time. So we're going to ask you to leave your cell phones. Like, we all would have known what they were doing, but it just been really funny to watch their attempt at marketing it that way. So I wish they would have done it, because it would have just been fun.
Well, I'd be curious, like, because they've asked people before to go airplane mode, right? Like Music City Open was an event that I was asked to put your phone in airplane mode. And I would assume that we got to this point because enough people weren't doing it. My next step, and someone actually brought this up on a live stream I was doing earlier, I wonder if they just went above and beyond of explaining why your phone needs to be on airplane mode. Like, hey, here's all the technical information you don't actually need to know, so you really understand why we need your phone on airplane mode right now. Like, I feel like people are just always gonna be more open to airplane mode than leaving your phone in your car. So it wouldn't surprise me if this is gonna go off worse for them than if they ask to put it on airplane mode.
Because now, like, everybody who brings their phone in,
mode, but like,
well, right now everybody who brings their phone in, well, they gotta be a lot of them,
they gotta
won't
be
do
checking.
Airplane mode.
They gotta be checking.
Who's gonna do that?
You don't think they're gonna be checking? This is not gonna be good at all if they're not checking. What the heck?
I don't know. I don't know.
They're sure not. I mean, I'm sure you'll get a few, hey sir, could you please put your phone away situations.
Like, not that hard to get by one of those little metal detector things.
Well, they're not gonna be metal detecting it out.
And just wand people. I mean, that's also super safe. That'd be nice.
They did say they're going to be doing bag checks, so it could be a part of that.
That's
process.
What I'm saying, Matt. You do a little boop boop bag check.
I'm saying, because they didn't wand at USDGC, did they? I don't believe
so. They started bag checking at Music City when the Natalie Ryan incident went down.
Yeah. So that wouldn't be a terrible thing for them to do.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't. It just gets me heated even thinking about it. Them not letting people take their phones.
I also think, Hunter, if you like explained it, people would still do it, because I'm pretty sure, like, I thought if you used your phone on an airplane when they told you not to, it would crash the plane.
It's fear-mongering. We need
that's what I thought. And people still did it. So I think people are still going to use their phone.
They probably would. I'm just saying, like, I feel like you get a better conversion rate over-explaining airplane mode than, hey, leave it in the car.
Because like I said, right now, I feel like if you let everybody bring their phone in and you, like, let's say you get signage, like you make it like to where everybody's going to see it at some point. Please put your phone on airplane mode. It's communicated to 95%. I would say that... Heck, I would say 50% of people put their phones on airplane mode. Like, it's not a crazy ask. Maybe they take it off at one point to send one text or one call, but then they probably put it back. It's pretty easy to get across. Now, I think you're going to have at least 50% of people bring their phone in anyways if they're not checking, and none of them are going to put it on airplane mode. So I don't really know what it accomplishes.
We had a email sent out one time. This was a couple years back of – I think one of the parks or something was like, hey, guys, you can't have dogs on the course. And I guess the Pro Tour kind of reached out to us as players being like, guys, do not have your dogs in the course. Like, the park is telling us you can't have it. And there was like a couple people that were like, we should just all bring our dogs and screw them. And I'm like, and what? Just have the tournament canceled? Like, what's our point? What's the point? So it's like there's always just going to be people that suck. I mean, there's always.
I want to say one thing to Hunter. When you're talking about the experience for the majority of viewers, I would consider myself in that majority. And I have never watched a whole round of live disc golf. I only watch post-produced coverage. And I do pay for I forgot the name right now. DGN to like watch the European Open coverage early and to watch Jomez without ads. But I think a lot of there are a lot more viewers on those post-produced videos than there are on the actual live coverage.
Just saying, I know ticket sales wise there's going to be more people watching live than people on the ground, so if you're sacrificing the live quality for people on the ground's experience, then that's where it's like, well, something's got to be done to cater to the majority.
But to be fair, the people on the ground also paid a heck of a lot more money.
Yeah, but the DGN makes more money off of the DGN than off of an event that they're just being paid to broadcast.
Yeah, well, this is not a good situation for anyone, honestly.
It just sucks all the way around.
For the people at home watching.
Well, yeah, and the best part is we heard from one of our coworkers that he was out there like testing cell service for them like what a few weeks ago or something. Like
they were testing it like a month or two ago, I think.
It wasn't
long ago. That's why this email just went out. Like they just found out, I think.
That's pretty tough for me to fathom. But you know, I get less surprised every day. All right, last topic for our final topic here. So this was originally an idea submitted by a fan. I kind of added a little twist to it because I thought of an extra idea. So hole 16 at Ottawa creates an interesting score separation and drama because it is reachable in two, but has some trouble to be found as well that could punish the aggressive play. So my question here is there ever a reason to have a long par four as opposed to a shorter par five? As long as the hole can also punish the aggressive shot. And this is obviously within the sport of disc golf. Is there ever really a benefit to have that long par four instead of maybe enticing the more aggressive shot, I guess? Lucas, what do you think?
I really can't think of a reason as a player or as a viewer why I would rather see a longer par four than a shorter par five. I think that the shorter par five will just always provide as much drama as a longer par four, even if there's some kind of a force carry or an island green, because that force carry to get an eagle, it just feels better as a player and a viewer to get an eagle as opposed to a birdie. And so when people say that par doesn't matter, I think that there's just a little bit of like short-sightedness there, because it does matter in terms of what it makes the players feel, what it makes the viewers feel, not necessarily as much as in terms of players going for it. I think the tour is so aggressive right now that par four versus five isn't really going to deter most players from going for whatever the best score they can get on the hole is. But I do think that that momentum build of getting an eagle versus a birdie, of clearing and getting to the green versus having to lay up short of it, I think that that momentum shift provides much more drama as a par five than as a par four.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely can add a spark to a round. No doubt about that. Brody, you love momentum. So what do you think about it?
I don't understand this question. Is there ever, Is there ever a reason to have a long par four as opposed to a shorter par five?
Mm-hmm.
So they're like, saying you can't, they don't, there's, they're asking, should you have both or should you never have both?
If you have a long par four, is there ever a reason, like it, basically
same hole.
It's the same hole. Let's say you have a hole that it would be as a par five, a like reachable par five. That maybe punishes the aggressive shot.
So now you're just saying changing the par. All you're saying is just make it from a four, make hole 16 a four instead of a five.
Right. I'm saying,
yeah, so and that would be a bad hole.
Anytime you have a hole like that, that would be a longer par four, is there ever a reason to have that hole?
So here's the thing. Yeah, you want to have long par fours. Like hole 16 at Idlewild would not be a good long par four. But there are holes that are good long par fours.
So
there's two different things. When you play a long par four, there should not be an easy route to get a par. You have to throw a difficult first shot. You have to throw a difficult second shot, and that might give you the opportunity of making a birdie. Now, you have to complete two difficult shots. If you mess up one of those difficult shots, you're probably in a position to where now you have to throw something really good to save your par. On a short par five, you now have the ability of getting an eagle if you throw two great shots and make a big putt, or you can throw three decent shots and make a birdie, or if you mess up one of those shots, you now are scrambling to make a par. Those are two different holes, and both of them need to exist in disc golf.
Remember, these questions are not my dire opinion. They're just ideas.
Well, I don't get this question. That's all I'm saying.
Okay. Hunter, please go ahead.
Yeah. So I'm going to disagree with Lucas and somewhat agree with Brody, more so that I think hole 16, where it brought this question up, might not be the perfect hole for this. But I think there's a lot of holes out there that maybe play as a shorter par five. That could be a longer par four or vice versa. Where I disagree with Lucas is I actually view this as the exact opposite thing. I think that making a lot of them as par fours where they're reachable in two is going to encourage aggressive play a lot more, because I think that disc golfers, especially on the tour, you're ingrained to like you're a birdie machine. You don't want pars, right? So if I'm looking and I'm like, I have a basically guaranteed birdie four if I were to just lay up and then, you know, lay up, tap out a four, it's very easy for me to four that. Very hard for me to three. Once that switches to a par four and that layup play is for par, I feel like you're a lot more enticed to go for it and try to get the birdie three because people are wanting to score. They're not wanting to take pars. So I think that has to be the line that people are riding of, is this something where I want to force more people to go for the green in two? If so, in my opinion, make that the long par four. Or if it's something where like this shot is a very low probability, it's really challenging, but it is doable, that's a great opportunity for a shorter par five, if that makes sense. So I think that both can exist. Idlewild at 16, I get to Brody's point, I think plays better as a shorter par five. I don't think it'd be a good par four, but I think there's a lot of holes out there that this line could be ridden like that. I just think making it a par four actually encourages that aggressive second shot.
Yeah. Is someone else going? Because
yes, Scott, weigh in on this before Brody loses his mind.
So when I was thinking about this question, I wasn't thinking about it as much from the player's perspective. I was thinking about it from the viewer's perspective. And I think that long par fours and short par fives both benefit the viewer. So me as a viewer, I love watching a player make that eagle, like Alvin final round making eagle on 16. I was very excited watching that, but I also love seeing a player execute two highly difficult shots on a long par four because I appreciate the difficulty of it. Like I think when we look at the Monster at the European Open, that course had a lot of very difficult par fours where you could be heavily punished, or you could really throw some excellent shots and walk away with a birdie. And I think for the viewer, that was very fun to watch. And for a player, that does build that momentum like Lucas was talking about. Maybe not as much as an eagle five, but it certainly is a huge confidence boost on an insanely difficult par four averaging above par. So I think that If you are looking for more score separation, you should focus on longer par fours that have the ability to be punished with a bad shot. If you want more excitement at your tournament, you should go for the shorter par five.
Okay. Yeah. Brody, go ahead now. You may.
Can I say something after Brody?
Yes.
Lucas, you can go first if you want.
Okay. If you don't care, sure. So kind of both to Hunter and to Scott. So I was thinking about it in terms of like excitement and scoring separation also. So I'm arguing, I think, that there's more scoring separation and more excitement from a shorter par five versus Hunter, you're saying that you think that there's more excitement and scoring separation from a longer par four.
No, I agree on the excitement on the par five. I was just saying I think you're gonna make more people attack the green in two on a par four because it's for birdie versus they can lay up for birdie, if that makes sense.
Okay. Can I jump in now?
Yeah.
You guys are missing a massive point here, and it's the actual hole and how the hole is designed. Hole 16, Hunter, no one plays that hole differently if it goes from a five to a four.
I said right. I said that wasn't the best hole to choose.
But you just said making a long par four, you would get more people to attack it.
I would bet statistically more people would attempt to reach, not drastically more, but I think more people would attempt to reach hole 16 and two, knowing that's my only way to get a birdie versus.
But everyone is already doing that to begin with, though. On that hole. Yes.
Everyone.
Yes. Everyone is trying to land it short of the OB.
Yeah.
And trying to make a 40, 50 foot putt. Everyone. The only people that aren't doing that are the people that like shank a shot like off the tee and are like not even.
But there's
up
some people that
spot.
Are going for the green.
No.
Isn't it a couple years ago that Paul threw an OB kind of short right and he still tried to go up to like that 40, 50 foot range? I feel like I remember that happening.
Yes, because it's a huge landing area.
Exactly,
everyone's trying to land it there. There is no risk.
16 isn't the best example. But people do try to go for that green.
Hunter, if you can find five people that are telling you that they are actually trying to land their disc on that green that is the size of like 25 feet.
I mean, I can find you footage of people going for the green.
That doesn't. Oh, so Joey Buckets was trying to make his final shot into 18 then.
No, but there's a drastic difference between I'm trying to lay up short and I'm throwing it deep into those woods. It's a drastic difference. It's a different shot.
Well, what I'm saying, Hunter,
that's not a great hole for this argument.
Right. And the question did say, is there ever a time? It was using hole 16 as the example.
I know, but a lot of people say that as like people are going to play differently if you change the par from four to five, and that's not how it's going to work. No. Well,
that's
like
what hole, I was saying. I don't think it will change it.
No one would change. Let's go to hole what?
Let's say hole two at New London. It's a really long par four right now.
That's the point I was going to bring up.
People would play it a lot safer if you played it as a par five. Yeah.
No, people would still go for the eagle if they throw a good drive.
Not as often.
But there'd be a large group of people that are like, I can get a really easy birdie here. Why would they not take that?
But
versus
they also
like go for the green and might make a par.
You can throw a putter or mid off the tee if you're going for birdie.
What are we talking about, guys? A stroke is a stroke. What are we talking about? It doesn't matter if it's an eagle or bogey.
People perceive it different.
Yes, bad golfers do, Hunter. Yes, people that are bad.
A lot of the disc golf field thanks in birdies. I want birdies. So if you give them,
and I would say those are bad. I would say those are bad disc golfers.
Well, a lot of people get to a course and they haven't played it or seen how it's going to play out. So the only thing they can judge that hole off of is not what is the field going to do. It's what's the par, what's the birdie, and if the birdie is the good thing, that's what they go for.
Can I give an actual facts instead of us just saying like, oh, this is how I think people would do it. Literally look at hole number, hold on, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, hole six. Look at hole six at Ledgestone. Okay, so you have the baseball hole over the baseball field. Then you have the very difficult par four.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of people that are playing that hole for par now has risen drastically. When I first played that tournament, so many people were going for birdie.
And you know why? Because they've seen the field play it and they know how it plays now in relation to the field.
You know why? Because they're better disc golfers on the course, Trevor. What are we doing? That's my point.
I'm just saying, like, if you have all these new players coming to New London and you made it a par five and people don't know, or you.
Trevor, you play that hole a couple times. You play that hole a couple times and you realize, getting a birdie on this hole is very hard if you don't throw a good drive.
You might not. You're talking about the best
disc golfers in the world. We're not talking about C-tier AMs.
What do you think it would do if you made hole six a par five? You think nothing changes at all at Ledgestone?
Hole six?
Yeah, the hole six at par five. At par four, I mean.
Dang, Silas.
Yeah, hold Silas, on. What the frick? How fast are you?
No, this par four.
If you made it a par five, you think it changes nothing?
I don't think it would change much because it'd be the same exact thing. You would have people that are attacking it for eagle, and you'd have people like myself that were playing it the same way. Hyzer spike, forehand spike, backhand four, moving on.
You don't think it would increase the amount of people playing for four?
The only thing I could see it changing, Hunter, is if it's later in the tournament. If it's later in the tournament, but that wouldn't matter if it's a par five or four. If that hole was later in the tournament, by what I'm saying is if that hole was like 16 or 17, someone that played it for par the first few rounds, I could see them changing their strategy if they need an extra stroke. But I don't see it at hole six. I don't see if you change that to a par five, I don't see everyone all of a sudden being like, oh, wow, I'm just going to do this.
Not everyone. I think more people would go for the birdie.
What would have to happen is they would have to do something like they did out at European Open, where they actually changed the hole to where they made you have to make a decision off the tee of do you want to try to clear hole three, the par five? Do you want to try to clear? No one's trying to clear that and play that for like a birdie. The birdie's too easy just to chip a forehand, chip a backhand, right? So you make a decision on the tee there. I think you would have to do that at that hole. If you made it a par five, you would have to change it to where players would have to make a decision off the tee of if they're trying to go to the second landing zone or the first landing zone. No one's changing their gameplay on hole six if you made that all of a sudden a par five. No one's doing that.
Okay.
I agree because of the shape of the shot.
Stroke is a stroke.
Yeah. You're throwing hyzer, so I think that's probably part of it too. Like we watched Calvin play that hole, and he just kind of throws hyzer at it. And so I don't think that changes if it's a par five. He's just able to throw two stock shots. I think the shape of the hole probably matters more than like the par.
I've heard a lot of
really good disc golfers like on tour previously. They might have changed how they think. This was definitely several years ago. I've heard a lot of them talk about, well, this is a par five. I can get a four every time. And then if it were to change.
Yeah, it's bad mentality.
I'm just saying, I've heard great disc golfers say it.
Yeah, and I think those great golfers have gotten smarter because I've played with some of them.
They might have. I'm just saying.
I've played with some of them at Ledgestone that would normally go for that hole. Yeah. And they don't go for that hole anymore because they're like, it's not worth potentially taking like a seven. I'm just going to take my pars every single round and then move forward.
It may be an older, disc golf.
I think that hole actually needs to change. I think that hole actually needs to change because it's too easy to get a par now.
I definitely see a lot of, I honestly, this is kind of a justice for par fours type question because there's a lot of people who get very attracted to the par fives because of the eagle opportunities. And I think it's sometimes, I'm more on the side of things where I like to see golfers closer to par. But
preserve hole 18. That hole doesn't change either if it's a par four. No one plays that hole differently if it's a par four. No one.
I think that hole.
Holy team.
Either laying up or they're going short.
Correct. You're either out of position and you're laying up short of the OB coverage.
Well, at the European Open, the one they changed to a par five, do you think more people are going for that first landing zone to go for the birdie if it's a par four?
People changed how they play that hole because of now there's a risk of throwing OB on your drive.
Too. I'm saying if they didn't change the par,
they didn't change the par. It was always a par five.
I said they made it a par five.
No. Hole three was always a par five. They changed. They added landing OB to now where players actually had to make a decision. So not everyone before they add the OB, everyone was just throwing their tee shot as far down there as possible because there was no risk.
Yeah.
But because they added the OB, now people are having to make the decision. Do I just chip a 250 foot shot or do I have to try to throw this tricky 420 foot cover? The changing that from a par four to a par five, I think even if you change a really, really hard hole to a par three, like that's the easiest way of thinking about it is like make a really hard par five into a par three.
Well, that's too drastic. Well, it's got to be achievable.
No. My point is people are still going to try to play that hole to score the best that they can score. Regardless of what the par is, they're going to say my skill level, this is the best I can score. That's what I'm going to go.
Owen's a perfect example. The reason why Owen is so competitive, even though she doesn't throw far, is she knows certain holes. If she tried to birdie those holes, she could bring in trouble into play. So she just plays those holes for par. She doesn't even look at
smarter,
the par.
I think it's definitely the smarter way.
And I'm saying that's, I think Trevor's right. I think back in the idea, like the whole idea of people playing like Iron Man, of where yeah, there's like, I'm not even keeping score. I'm doing everything as a par three score. Like that made no sense for me going into golf. It's like, there's pars. Why aren't we doing that? I think that mentality is slowly getting phased out. And now we're starting to see, I mean, have you ever listened to Gannon talk about how he breaks down holes? Like these are what kids are talking. These are what people are thinking about now. They're actually like thinking about how to break down a hole versus just stepping up and ripping it. And a lot of that has to do with course design. Because back in the day, you could just throw your shot wherever and you could still make a par. You could still make a birdie. It didn't matter. Now you do that, you're making a bogey. You're making a double. And on some of these courses, you make a bogey or double. And now all of a sudden, you might be out of the tournament.
Yeah. I mean, it's a question of psychology. Comment down below. Weigh in. Do you think the changing of a par changes the mentality significantly of players and what they're aiming to do? We're going to move on to our final.
Of the top players in the world.
Sure.
Real quick. Yes. Do you guys think hole two at New London is a par four or a par five?
Par four.
It's par four.
It's a four. It's just a very hard four.
You have to throw a really good, you have to actually throw a really good challenging tee shot.
Well, I will say this with OB, you could make it would be a fine five. I don't think anybody would question it if it were a five.
With, that would be with way too easy. I think a par five. I think
hole 18 with the double OB might need to be a par five. Yeah, OB on that's both actually sides, a bigger question.
That hole's a monster with OB on both sides.
Oh, they're
sides.
Doing both OB on
oh my
18?
Gosh, it's a monster. Yeah.
I like that. It takes away the rollers.
Nobody's gonna three it though.
That's my problem.
I don't think anybody will ever three it.
People are going because it's hard to get aggressive on the drive.
So why that hole I think is bad now is because now there's, like you said, I don't think there's gonna be that many threes. And so majority of people are gonna go putter, 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 par and end it. And so the score separation is gonna be terrible.
Yeah.
I think it's hole 18 a day three, not final day. Cause yeah,
I would move that tee bad back like an extra couple hundred feet and make it a par five.
You gotta go back or up. One of the
back
two.
Or up. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. You gotta make it to where a drive can get past those trees.
For sure. Yeah. For sure. All right, we're going to move on to our final topic here. We've got Hunter and Lucas. You guys are tied up right now, so I'm thinking of a number between 1 and 10. Hunter, take a guess.
2.
Lucas?
You're doing 3.
Dirty here.
Yeah. 3. Did you hear me? Sorry.
Oh, sorry, I didn't. 3, yeah, that's the right choice. It was 6, so... the 2 out of 10 chance there.
I was trying to lock in. I thought I nailed you.
Would you like to go first or second, Lucas?
I'll defer to Hunter. I'll let him go first.
Okay. He gives Hunter the ball. Now this is a mouthful. So, but you know, just hear me out. So Ryan Mon recently came under fire on social media after winning his third amateur major of the season, completing the what they're calling the Am Slam. Commenters were disgusted that he stuck in the AM division while winning many MPO tournaments and dominating the AM scene since the beginning of the year, claiming he is sandbagging and should have moved up sooner. Should the MA1 division implement any kind of restrictions in the future other than the acceptance of cash to protect any notion of a below pro level division structure? What purpose do you think this division serves, and why do you think there's been so much outrage surrounding it? Hunter, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I don't think MA1 needs a change. In my opinion, it's the highest level of amateur competition that's out there. So as long as someone is willing to stay an amateur, they should be able to compete in that division. It's just that simple. If you're upset at this, don't get bitter, get better. I can understand the frustration around someone playing down, right? Like playing down to MA2 or down to MA3 just to get wins. I get that. I get where people get frustrated there. But when people are getting frustrated just because a dude is winning multiple amateur majors, one of them being Junior Worlds. So one of them, half the people who are upset aren't even qualified to play in, because you got to be a junior to play in it. It's just crazy to me. The restriction on staying in the AM field, there is a restriction there, right? Like you can't accept cash. You have to stay an amateur. That's a pretty big restriction, because I don't really know too many people that are playing local MPO scenes and mopping the floor with them, right? That would rather have like plastic than cash. Like the majority of people would much rather have cash, but they turn it down because they want the chance at these AM major titles. So why are they playing MPO then? Great question. I'm glad you asked. Well, it's because the best level of competition available to them regularly is their local MPO scene, and that's what's going to help them prepare the most for their end goal, which is these AM majors. So they play MPO because they want to go against the best people that are available to them regularly, and then, you know, in preparation for this. The other thing too is 95% of the time, and Ryan Mon is one of these people, once you win these AM majors, that's it. Like, that was your goal. That's what you were working towards, and now you're ready to move up. That's what you were, like, here for. And he said that, like, I won it. I'm ready. That's my last amateur tournament. So people who get upset at this, like, you're literally just upset because the guy beat you, and this time the kid beat you. And, like, that's all it is. So it gets me worked up because, like, MA1 exists to be the top of the amateur ranks. What is an amateur? Someone who hasn't made money yet. So turning down cash, he is subjecting himself to being an amateur.
Yeah. They're fired up. They're fired up. Lucas, what do you have to add?
Yeah, I think this has been kind of a problem in disc golf for a while now. Like, even people in MA3 and MA2 are having this argument. Like, we have, for those divisions, I think it's even more egregious because you have a rating cap. Like, even though ratings aren't great, we all know that, there is still an objective measure to determine whether or not you can play in this division. And I've heard people complain since I started playing disc golf, oh, this guy is sandbagging, he should play up. He's not sandbagging, because the definition of sandbagging is not applicable here, because we have an objective measure that tells you where you should play at based on your PDGA rating. I think the same thing goes for MA1, but instead of the rating, again, 100 mentioned, it's this cash. Amateur division is there to develop players to be ready for the pro field. And thankfully, they haven't limited those players from playing in pro tournaments. They just limited them from accepting cash. And Ryan beat me in an A tier this year. He's already won an A tier, and he's declined cash in that A tier. So it's not like, again, he's making a sacrifice here to refuse accepting money to play on these amateur tournaments, the AM Worlds, the AM US Championships, and the AM Junior, because there is a very defined, even if it's a little bit less developed in other sports, there's a defined amateur to pro status, and that's been winning AM Worlds and winning the AM Majors for a while now. And so since he's done that, he now has a very direct line to manufacturer sponsorships, to do they still reward pro? I know they rewarded the tour cards for the NADGT series. They might. I don't know if they do that for the majors or not. But now he has possibly entry into other fields because of winning these. And so because he's an amateur and he hasn't accepted cash, he's made that sacrifice. It's allowed him to get a leg up before he moves into the pro field, while still allowing him to have that competition with really good players who can challenge him still.
Yeah. I think the biggest disconnect is people hear amateur and they just think less than pro, when realistically the separation is for pay and not for pay. And the protected AM divisions are a completely different thing than MA1. Brody's turned himself upside down. Can we go into the four window?
What happened?
Yeah, I think you guys.
Yeah, I feel like I should have been in that final. I'm not gonna lie.
Could I say one thing?
Yeah.
Actually, Ryan competed.
He competed in 3 Elite Series Pro Tour events before he played the Amateur Disc Golf World Championship. He also has 4 sponsors already. It does seem strange for someone to be able to play in a pro tour event in the first place and then go play the amateur world championship.
Can I one up you? Can I one up you?
Yeah.
You know what's even crazier is if someone plays in a major championship and then can play in amateur events. Because you know what other sport allows that? The one that our sport was created after, golf.
I can't think of it seriously.
I know. Why is he upside?
You guys both covered that topic pretty well. I think Hunter going first just had a little bit more to spit out first there. Bold play on the defer, though. I'd always respect the defer. Good performance, though. Thank goodness. Silas flipped him.
Silas flipped him.
Yeah. Wow. Oh, man. Got him again.
That's fun.
Oh, man. Always getting the great special effects. Oh, now you're just mirrored. There we go. Oof, that was ever, man. If you ever look at your face, like the opposite direction, you look so like unfamiliar. Anyways, before this gets any further out of hand, Hunter, congratulations. You're a winner. You were a few minutes late. I should just dock you a few points for that. But I won't, out of the goodness of my heart.
Yeah, I mean, look, last week I was fighting an ankle injury. Ankle injury's back. This week I lost a toenail. Same foot. So
tell the people what shirt you were wearing when you hurt your ankle.
Man of the people. I was wearing the man of the people shirt. Yeah. Brody Smith broke my ankle. You heard it here first.
Brody Smith and leg injuries.
You know, hopefully quick recovery. I don't know what shirt I was wearing when I that shelf came out of nowhere and broke my toenail off, but here we are.
I don't know why I think that so much.
Dang.
It's just a light. Anyways, that is really getting me. If you want to submit any topics for debate night, I gotta stop looking at it.
Staring contest, Trevor. Staring contest.
I can't do it. That's making me laugh so much. I just look up. I have this big monitor. I just look up and I see this giant light coming from where Brody's face should be. It's really getting me. Somebody needs to make a. That needs to be a gift. If you want to submit any topics for debate night, you can scan the QR code on the screen. Maybe just cover up Brody's face with that. And you can also click the link in the description. And love reading the topics. We have a ton of submissions. I think we have around 214 for the
Goodness.
Year. Yeah. So everybody keeps rolling them in. Appreciate it. I always look through them. So keep doing that. And we will see you next week. We're getting close to Worlds. So next week's episode will be kind of a Worlds preview.
I think I'll be in studio.
I'll say in person. Yeah. In studio.
Oh, gosh. Yeah,
just go head to head, gloves off.
Might have to. Yeah, maybe. Do we finally get Yuli on debate night?
Oh, we could do it.
Robbie will be in town too.
We could do a team debate night. Team debate night.
I call Yuli.
We could do team debate night. That could be electric.
There's definitely a possibility. So you're not going to want to miss it. Tune in next week for debate night. It's going to be great. A lot of people in town. We'll see you then.
Can I?